We have talked about the human brain on other occasions and divided it into three functions, which we have called snake, dog, man. The snake part is the spinal cord. The dog part is the middle part, and the man part is the covering part of the brain, the most recent development. Now, what we want to demonstrate is that we can use the same threefold division and rename it. You know that when you're studying anything at all, you first study a very simple form of it, and you pass from the known to the unknown. You take a very, very simple, concrete material fact, like one snake, one dog, one man. And when people have become familiarized with that and the vocabulary related to it, then you extend it. And we change the terms progressively to extend the significance of what we're talking about. And we're going to keep the snake as snake. We're going to keep the man as man, but we're going to change the meaning of the dog into woman. Because, as you know, dogs are full of faith. And we shall demonstrate that women specialize in faith, as men specialize in reason. We're going to say that the rabbis, when they referred to the Garden of Eden, actually referred to the human head, with the bounding wall, the bones of the skull. So we're going to say there is a garden, and in the garden there is a snake, a woman, and a man. And we're going to consider the relations between these three. Now, the snake is fundamentally the hedonist, the one dedicated to pleasure. You know, that word hedonism is a Greek word simply meaning pleasure. And we're going to distinguish between pleasure and happiness in a special way, so that we will never again confuse them and take one for the other. Before we do that, we're going to remind ourselves that the brain is an evolute of the spinal cord. That is, the spinal cord grew through a series of negations, pains, inexperience, thrown back from the apophyseal center, and climbed up, and then began to develop itself and to swell up until it became the brain that we have today. So that the spinal cord growing upwards made a bulb for itself, like the head of a snake, and then grew round that snake a further zone, and then round that zone another zone, bringing us into the realm of rationality. Now, in the story of the Garden of Eden, it is stated that man was made male-female in one body to begin with. They were not separated out, and they were given a command not to presume to know what is good and what is evil. The reason for that command was this: if a finite creature decides what is good and what is bad, it will fall into thinking in terms of good being equivalent to pleasure and bad equivalent to pain. And that will divide the being, because then the being will decide to pursue pleasure and to avoid pain. Now, the original life, as we know it biologically, is an animal that feeds, a monocell, which we know in the amoeba, which then elongates itself, as we see in the Paramecium. And this elongated form became symbolized in the snake, the serpent. Now the serpent represents the triple S, sensuous self-satisfaction. It is devoted entirely to a hedonistic view of life. It doesn't want to know anything painful. The life force itself moves towards pleasures and away from pains. We demonstrate this in the case of a single cell like the amoeba by putting food particles in the water near it, and we see that it pushes out a filament of protoplasm called a pseudopodium, a false foot, and it engulfs that material that we put into the water. But if we drop some lemon juice, the same foot that advanced to the food, being stung by the bite of the acid, will withdraw. So in the monocell we see a very simple demonstration of what sensuality means. It means moving towards pleasure and away from pain. Now pleasure is defined as that sensation that one has when an input of energy is easily assimilated. It is assimilated at leisure. Pleasure means that the stimulus rate determines your condition. Will you please photograph that in your mind? Pleasure is passive to the stimulus. Pleasure is determined by the rate of the stimulus. If the stimulus comes in at such a rate that it can easily be assimilated, it is experienced as pleasure. But if we increase the rate of stimulation so that the energy input is very high and it becomes difficult to assimilate the energy input, that difficulty is experienced as displeasure. And if we increase the input to a very high rate, it actually becomes unassimilable and it begins to break down the tissue, the protoplasm, and that is called pain. So when the stimulus is determining your condition, you are at the level of the aesthetic. The aesthetic means your feeling life of pleasure pain. Now, as the brain developed out of this cord and gradually extended itself by accumulating experience, we can say that the primary snake-like part of it is the first aesthetic state, the state of non-discriminate pursuit of pleasure. But when in the pursuit of pleasure, that appetite, and remember all life is fundamentally appetite, when that appetite swallows something and finds that some element in that thing, which may be impure, is difficult to assimilate, then it has discomfort and maybe pain. And because it does not like pain, it tries to throw out the source of the stimulus. It can do that either by vomiting immediately, which you can see animals do when they take something unpleasant, or it can do it by having diarrhea. It can manage out the other way very, very quickly. But by the time that it has actually experienced the discomfort or the pain, it is too late to get rid of it before it happened, so that it forms a record of its pain, which it doesn't like, which it can't get rid of. It may vomit, it may have diarrhea, but it makes a record of it, and the record is thrown backwards from the food tube in the belly and becomes the spinal cord. It goes upwards, and every new pain adds to your discrimination. So we can say that the original aesthetic, the primary serpent, is essentially pleasure-loving, and not until it has a pain does it become discriminate. The source of discrimination is pain. The source of intelligence is pain. And we have to remember that fact, because if we do, we won't be so scared of pain. We rather welcome it as increasing our intelligence. Now, because the three parts of the brain are outgrowths of that primal serpent or apatial snake, we can say the first snake is the first immediacy, the first sensuous pursuit of pleasure. The next one is rather more careful because it's had some unhappy experiences. And the third one, the man section, has now become to reason how to avoid pains and how to secure pleasures. So then we can say there are three snakes there. A first snake, totally uneducated. A middle snake, partially educated, but still in contact with the first one. And then the third snake, the man snake, which has become discriminate through painful experiences. And so we can say, let us look at this snake. The middle part of it is still tainted by the first stage. And the highest part is separated from the first stage by the middle stage. And we're going to call this the serpent in the Garden of Eden. That is your garden. And we're going to call the part that's away from it, not in direct contact, Adam. And the middle part we're calling Eve. Now we can see immediately why the rabbi said that it was the woman, that it was Eve, that tempted Adam. It is the middle part of the brain, still in contact with the sense pleasure-loving part of the brain, that suggests to the rational part of the brain, that is more or less insulated, that it would be a good thing to have pleasure. And there might be a pop song written by somebody somewhere in which the theme would go something like, I want a relation. Now you all know this voice, it is the voice of woman. Woman wants a relation. And we won't see the rationale of this. The woman is still in contact with the pleasure. She's still a natural hedonist. And she's not been hurt hard enough or often enough to make her definitely ascetic, to turn her away from the sensuous life. But the accumulations of pains in the forebrain that have made man into a rationalist, those accumulations have made man definitely decide that pleasure is our suspicion. The function of the Eve, or woman, is to make a relationship between the free, sensuous experience of pleasure and the rationale. Now, the rational part is full of evidences of past pains and has made a lot of rules how to avoid pains, and has become so preoccupied with the rules about how to avoid pain that it's hardly got time to expose itself to pleasure without thinking about it. Now the female, the Eve, knows perfectly well that if you think about the pleasure, you spoil it. So the Eve doesn't want the thinker to think of anything that would get in the way of the pleasure. So the woman is all trying to link the pleasure thing to the rationale of the man and break down the man's defences against the painful effects of pleasure. Now, because the whole process is really a serpentine development, a development of primordial motion, the root of Na, N-A, as in Nachash, a serpent, means an undulating free motion. You find it in the Buddhistic Ananda, absolute bliss, and the same with Hindu yoga, the same word is used for bliss, and it means a state in which you can freely go along without having to be on guard and having transcended all possibilities of pain to move infinitely without impedance. In Catholic Christianity, that is called the state of beatitude, to be in absolute free motion with no impediments. Now, because it's all a snake, I brought my serpent with me to show you the Aaronic rod and what it signified. You know, Aaron, friend of Moses, had a trick of turning a snake into a rod, or a rod into a snake, and gobbling up other snakes belonging to Egyptians. Now the symbology is quite simply this. The dangling snake there is the free, vibrant life force, but the wooden snake here, the stiff one, has become stiff through being on guard against pains. It makes itself stiff to firm itself up against possible attack. Now we have two snakes here, a stiff one, the rod, and a very loose one. Now the loose one signifies the first aesthetic, the simple love of pleasure, not even thinking about pain, just pursuing pleasure carelessly like a baby does before it hits itself in the eye with a rattle. So the wriggling snake down there represents the snake in its primordial, even before audio, before there is an order at all, moving and wriggling at will. You will find that in all yoga systems, all meditation systems, the attempt is to get back to that state of primary bliss without losing the faculty of defense against pain. Now, just as the free wiggly snake represents sensuality, not on guard, able to enjoy itself without consideration, so this wooden stick represents the same appetite, now made very hard against temptation. It has become entirely rationalized, entirely logical. Now, if it remains in the state you see, there is no relation happening between the sensuous wriggling snake and this stiff wooden snake that represents the perfectly rationalized male mind. So the only way there can be a relation is that the wriggling snake must wrap round the stiff snake. You see, the stiff snake can't wrap round the other snake, can it? So that actually a man cannot, because of his reason, allow his natural affection to relate to his wife, his lover, his girlfriend, or whatever. His reason will not allow it. His reason has been evolved over millions of years to stop that dangerous thing, pleasure, because pleasure gets you into trouble and finally into pain. So it is not in the male where the relational possibility is. The male is so preoccupied with the rationale of defense against pain that it refuses to let go of its governing concept. And its governing concept is be on guard, be watchful. So that means that it is the female part, the free, non-rationalized, wiggling, hip-shaking part, that has to do the wraparound. So that when we make this wraparound, we're showing the kind of relation that the woman is willing with the man. She's willing to wrap round the man, because if she doesn't, he won't. Because his reason will guard him against the pains that arise from pleasure. Now, when the stick remains stiff and unyielding, when the reason remains on guard, then that poor feminine serpent there, winding round it, is not getting the kind of response that it wants to get. And so it starts crying out, I want a relation. And the male aspect says, the only safe relation is a rational one. I must have a reason for everything I do, and you must have a reason for everything you do, And if you have a reason, I must be on guard against it, because the only reason you have is to wrap round me, because you are addicted to this primary loose pleasure relationship. Now, what is going to happen? If the purely rationalized man, the intellectual man, remains intellectual in this way, and if the feminine part remains freely hedonistic, like that serpent, only prepared to wriggle delightfully, there is going to be no relation. Now, compromise is a very horrible thing, really. Because when you compromise, you don't do either of them properly. You find a middle thing between, where the reason is not reason and the pleasure isn't pleasure. So the only thing to do about it is to educate both sides to understand the other side. Now, luckily, every human being has these three functions in the head. And we're going to see why Christ is crucified in Golgotha, meaning the place of the skull, because when the sensuous life stimulated the feminine receptive, and the feminine receptive tainted the masculine reason, so that the reason moved down into the sensuous, it went down the spine, went right down the spine to the basal plexus, in the sacrum, and it went down and out. You know, the expression down and out means going down the spine and forward in the lower sensuous part of the tummy and out. It moves down towards sexual relationships, and in the process of going down, the energy that's come down there sets itself up a rival center in the sacral plexus. In Hindu yoga, that is called the serpent power resting in that basal plexus, kundalini. The female serpent power of pure sensuous fantasy down in the basal plexus at the bottom of the spine. And she's setting itself up as an anti-center to the brain. And it would try to send messages from there continuously to suggest that this being shall involve itself back again, always into the hedonistic pleasure zones in the body. So the brain replies by putting a force across here to stop the force from below coming up. That is called, in the book of Genesis, an angel with a flaming sword keeping the expelled Adam and Eve from returning to the garden. If you go back to the guarded place, the Garden of Eden there, and you balance your reason and your sensuality and the mediator, then you become again a perfect hermaphroditic being. Now every man and every woman is totally, completely hermaphroditic. That is to say, every man has a reason under which he's hidden an affection, under which he's hidden an impulse, conclination towards pleasure. But every woman has not only a pleasure contact, but a rational contact. So that instead of compromising uneasily, where the woman says, oh, forget your reason, and the man says, forget your sensuality, they both remember the trio in themselves. This is a divine triad corresponding with the Trinity in Christianity and in Hinduism and in various other forms in psychology. Cognition, affection, conation. Conation is a pleasure drive. Affection is the way your emotions are activated by the stimulus. And reason is the totality of guards formally set up inside. Now, you are not going to allow the fantasies of millions of years of sensual delights stored in the base of the spine to invade the brain and overthrow it, because if you do, that would be insanity. It's a very interesting, simple way of finding out what kind of an illness it is in a being according to its location in the body. The forces are working against each other. The brain against the low part of the spine. The basal plexus of the spine is working against the brain. So that if the symptom appears high up the spine, it means that the lower part, the pleasure part, is invading the territories that belong to brain control. And if the symptom is low in the body, it means that the brain forces of inhibition have pushed their way down the spine and are gripping and controlling that sensuous light. Now, if we think about this very carefully, we can see the solution to all human relations. The relation is the wraparound, like this, in which the reason, instead of ceasing to be what it is by request of the affective life, says, no, I will be reasonable and recognize that we are three serpents, and I will allow the serpents to have their place. It will not be compromised, it will be intelligent assessment. And the affective feminine will say, I will allow your reason and not complain about it, because the sensuous part, left to itself in first immediacy, always leads into trouble. It's not possible for you to follow a pleasure stimulus and become happy. Now, we said we would define the difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure is dependent on the character and intensity of the stimulus. In other words, it is passive to its object. Pleasure is passive to its object. Now, happiness means exactly the opposite. Pleasure is dependent on the character of the objective stimulus that acts on the organism. Happiness is what happens when you understand yourself thoroughly in your three functions, so that happiness is activity. Pleasure is passivity to the object. Happiness is subjective activity. Subjective means that the knowing subject, the being, that zone of sentient power which constitutes the being, is in charge of its own process. And you all know the difference, because when you are being stimulated from outside, you can feel yourself extroverting and going under the dominion of the stimulating object. You are passive, you are a slave. To be passive means to suffer. To suffer means to be underneath and to have to bear what happens to you because you did not take over your own activities. But the word happiness comes from a word meaning from a hierarchical sense of power to posit one's own essence. From a proper sense of hierarchy, actively to posit one's own essence. Now that is happiness. Now the utilitarians, the hedonists of all ages, right from the Greeks up to modern times, all say that pleasure is the aim of life. But funnily enough, all the best religions say that that is not true. Happiness is the true aim of life. And never do you find a proper distinction between pleasure and happiness. But the actual distinction is simply that pleasure makes you passive to the object, at the mercy of the object, and therefore not free. Now you know that everything you do under compulsion is repugnant to your will. Supposing you get a baby who's supposed to be feeding, and it's not feeding. So you get hold of the baby's hand, and you get hold of the spoon in the baby's hand, and you shovel up with your energy, holding the baby's hand, a spoonful of food, and you push the baby's arm towards its face, and you open its mouth with your other hand, and you shovel in the food. Now, does the baby like it? On baked food, does it like it that way? No. Therefore, the basic principle is any act imposed from outside the being is repugnant to its will, simply because it's being forced on it from outside and reducing that being to a passive state, a slave state. And what does that mean to us? If we are being stimulated by any object that is external to our own being, and in such a way that we cannot resist the stimulus, and we are at the mercy of the stimulus, then we are quite definitely subhuman. Now, you remember in our mnemonics, using our five digits, we have mineral, vegetable, animal, human, superhuman, angelic, and divine. The mineral is your physical body, in which the type of minerality is the bones. The vegetable is your digestive system. The animal is your capacity for moving. The human is your capacity for logic. The superhuman is your capacity for free will. The angelic is your capacity for seeing the cosmic law governing it all. And the divine is your absolute awareness of those lower processes. And the divine is transcendent, that is infinitely beyond you, but also immanent in your center. Now, when you are behaving like a mineral, you can be picked up by somebody else and put down. The technical word for that is lamen in English, and in Latin, idiota. Idiot is simply Latin for layman. And the layman is a man who knows so little about himself that he can pick him up and put him down again. Now, what human being likes to be a layman in any field, he doesn't like it. Because it means somebody can pick him up and demonstrate, this is a man. Now, you know that William Blake said, a grain of sand is a man. Because the whole universe is made of sentient power. Power is sentient. So that this thing, this pen, actually feels to itself like a pen. But it has no legs and arms, and it can't stop me going like this with it. It may be happy where it is, at rest. When you attain a state of perfect internal rest inside your being, physically, mentally, spiritually, then you are said to be in heaven. So when that's at rest, that's okay. That's a pen's heaven lying there. But if I pick it up and say, well, I'm not going to let it be at rest, I will tap the chair with it and tap that with it to demonstrate a point. I've got a pair of things here. I think I'll put that in there, if it will go, like that. And I'll push it along there. I hope it will stay. It's actually trying to get out. It'll stay. Now I've got a squeeze on it. Now you know that molecularly, that steel clip is pressing on the molecules of that pen and restricting the free motion of the electrons spinning around the nucleus of the atoms. So to put that in that is to give it a sense of inhibition, a sense of difficulty of motion, a sense of discomfort. And I am doing it to the pen. And I call it a lay person because I can lay it whenever I want to lay it. So the mineral world is very easily laid down. Now the vegetable world is slightly cleverer. Because if you get hold of a seed and you say, I don't want today, I'll throw you away, and it falls on a bit of damp ground, it'll put down a root and start growing. And if you're not quick, it'll make seeds and it'll have them blown away on the wind beyond your reach. Its method of escape from the layman idiot position is to grow and to make seeds to reproduce and fly away from your control. And the next stage, the animal, is to get up, lift your roots out of the ground, turn them into limbs, and run away when it sees you coming. It's a method of escape from being treated as a lay object, is simply to run away. And the next stage of escape is the human way, which says, I am going to study the hierarchy of forces in the universe. Now let's distinguish between the word man and the word human. They distinguish very clearly in the medieval period between man and human in this manner. If an act is done in response to a stimulus by that biped that we know is potentially human, and yet when the stimulus comes he cannot control himself, if he finds that he's done something and afterwards wish he hadn't, that is called the act of a man. It's interesting that the medieval scholastics actually worked it out. An act that is done by a potentially human being, that means potentially means held in power, not actually human, because it has no sense of hierarchical self-determination. The biped that we call roughly mankind, when reacting to an external stimulus without the capacity for resisting it and determining its own course of action, that is called the action of a man. But if that same being is educated and reminded that he has a potential of resistance to stimuli inside him, and he does his exercises and he actually learns to control himself a bit, then because he is in conscious control of his own intellect and his own will, that is called an act of a human. So we distinguish very carefully between a man act, mankind in general, called the mass, the herd, the many, those who react statistically roughly about 95% of people, those who so react, we mass them together and say that is mankind. Mensly. All too manlike. It is stimulated, it reacts to the stimulus, it goes under the dominion of the stimulus, is made passive and reduced to the level of a layman, or in the Latin derived word, to the level of an idiot. Now, idiot is I-D-O-T. I, the subjective personal observer, Dio, God, the divine, locked in the body, and T, crucifixion. Idiot means that there is a God there, but he doesn't know he's a God. He's behaving like a layman. He's behaving like one who is passive to the stimulus. He has no power of self-determination. And therefore, he's called an idiot, a crucified God, who doesn't know it. Now, we've had it before. There's no harm in repeating something that's useful. A God called Indra, looking from heaven, looked down in the forest and saw a wild boar going by with great strength. What a lovely feeling. I will go down into that wild boar's body and see what it is like. And he went down. It was very enjoyable going about grunting and tearing through the forest, ripping things up and looking for truffles. It was marvelous. And he became so identified with it that he forgot that he was really the god, Indra. And for a long, long time he was down there. Meanwhile, things in heaven that should have been, let us say, up here, the heaved up place, heaven means heaved up, in heaven, this Indra function, which means internal discrimination, was not operative. And the gods, that is the intelligences in your head, said, why is there no discrimination within? And somebody looked around and said, well, actually Indra has gone down. And that's why there is no discrimination. Oh, well, that's terrible, because we cannot be intelligent divine beings, because divine means discrimination, if Indra is not up where he should be in the head. So they sent out a messenger to scout for him, and eventually the messenger saw a wild boar in the forest. It was a bit super, so he knew it wasn't an ordinary wild boar. It was a very super type wild boar, rather like Zeus on an amorous excavator. So they went to him and said, "Oh, Indra," and he replied, and he had no vocabulary, other than a few snorts and grunts. So we thought, what can we do? We can't remain in heaven in the state of permanent enlightenment unless he comes back home. So they said, "Oh, well, what's he got?" He had a wife, nice sow, and lots of lovely piglets. Those of you who held piglets know how lovely and strong and sensuous they are, very self-enjoying type creatures, which is why you have a pig in the middle of the wheel of life in the Buddhist system. So they killed the piglets, and he grunted, and they killed the wife, and he grunted, but he still didn't know he was Indra. So then they cut him up and dragged him out of the body. And then when he was dragged out, he said, "Good gracious, how on earth did I forget my divine self?" And they said, "Don't waste time wondering that one out. It's simple. It was identification. It was pleasure that took you into it. You saw something enjoyable, you went down this lovely fine hollow canal in the spine, and you finished up in the realm of sacral fantasies. And therefore you forgot who you were. Anyhow, we let you out now. Come back up and discriminate." Now that Hindu story is exactly the same significance as the Christian story of the return of the prodigal son to his father's house in heaven. Now, we have, as human beings, that is hierarchically conscious beings, in full awareness that we have a reason, an affection, and a conation, three functions, a basic drive, conation, corresponding with the primary serpent, movement towards pleasure, an affection which allows us to feel the relative intensity of the pleasures or pains, and a formal rationalizing mind, the male mind, that actually computerizes and programs all the formal information. Now look at our problem. In the forebrain, the male part of the brain, we have millions of years of formal information. Now form is cyclic, circumscribed, clear demarcation. In the forebrain we have form. Now a form can only be clear if you suppress its feelings. That's tremendously important. Only if you stop liking and disliking can you be formally clear. So the forebrain is dedicated to formal estimation. And by the recognition of the form, it is able to say that would cause trouble, that would cause less trouble, and that might cause no trouble. But it does it by form. So that the male part of the human being, whether in a woman or a man, that male part actually adds up and measures the form of the situation. But in the midbrain, it doesn't like form, because form is restrictive of feeling. The mid part, the feminine part of the brain, says to itself, if I become too clear in my reasons, I find that the energy that has become clarity has reduced the flux of like and dislike. That's very interesting, that the affectionate nature is in a state of flux. You flow towards, and as you feel a restriction, you flow back. The moon waxing and waning is the very type of that activity. the affective life, the life of feeling, evaluates pleasures and pains. And it does this by letting itself flow. There is a moving of a psychic field of power flowing towards the object, and if the object is very clearly defined, when the flow reaches the hard definition, the flow stops. But when it stops, the feeling stops. That's very interesting. In other words, where the clearly defined male idea is, there is no feeling. There's a very good reason why there is no feeling. Namely, the accumulation of millions of years of pain has made us go on guard, has made us harden our definitions. But the affective life, when it comes to the clear idea, feels, if I wrap myself around this clarity, I will define my edges, my affective flow will stop. But my feeling is the only thing worth having, says the affective nature. But the male brain says no. Intellectual clarity is the only thing worth having, because it defends us from the pains of subjection to the outer object stimulus. Meanwhile, underlying those two is the old serpent that says the only thing worth experiencing is pleasure. Subjecting oneself to unimpeded stimulation. Find the stimulus that you can assimilate and just lie down and let the stimulus come in. So we have these three processes, a conition, an urge towards pleasure. Now don't confuse me by thinking. I don't want to think, I want pleasure. And the rational masculine thinking process, it says, all pleasures have led to pains in the past, and I think I now know enough not to need any more lessons. So I will not have you. I will not subject myself to sensuality. This is very funny, because it means that in that part of the brain which is masculine, rational, intellectual, you don't have a feeling sensation like you do in the midbrain part. And that midbrain part doesn't have it quite in the simple pleasure pursuit of the original part of it, the snake brain. What does this mean for human evolution? It means that until we become thoroughly conscious of this triplicity of functions in us, we can never attain ultimate happiness. Now those people like Jeremy Bentham, like Mill and others, like Epicurus, like many of the Greek hedonists, who said the purpose of life is pleasure, were quite wrong, because pleasure means that you are subjected to the object as a stimulus, made passive to it, at the mercy of it, and you cannot guarantee the continuance of your pleasure, because the object may be removed. But on the other hand, if you take yourself in hand and become totally active to yourself, you yourself posit your own essence by your own hierarchical evaluation of what you truly are in being. Now let's consider the difference between an animal and a man. You know that kind-hearted, sentimental people think that their dogs and their cats have souls. Well, they have, because the word animal is from animal, which means soul. Soul is defined as the self-moving substance. There is a soul in the plant, there is a soul in the animal, there is a soul in the man and in the human. But these souls are not the same. some people think that maybe in the spirit world their pet doggy will be there. I'm quite serious. And I know spiritualist mediums who actually see spirit dogs walking about. I'm not saying they don't. I'm going to explain why they do. Now, in the wild animal, the non-domesticated animal, the whole of its energy is spent in its body process. It is spent food seeking, sleeping, playing, copulating, reproducing. All its energies are spent in body processes. Now, because the whole of its energies are spent in the body processes, when through the accumulation of toxins in the body the animal dies, then the energy that was focused on the body has nothing to focus on. Now, that focus was actually, the word tells you, focus means power strike. It precipitated itself inwards onto that body. And when the body is removed, what it does, it attenuates. It returns to its infinitely stretched out state so that it does not exist after death. It is an attenuated field. Remember, the word exist means to stand out. It means to be gathered together in such a way that you stand out, obviously, from the environment. So that when an animal dies, a wild animal dies, that animal has no image of any process other than its physical, factual existence. And when through the accumulation of toxins in the body, or through accident, or predation of another being, it is killed, that animal field, that biofield, attenuates, stretches out, and there is no animal there. There, in a location. Now, when a human being dies, something quite different happens. A human being, remember, is defined as a being unlike an ordinary man. A human being is a being with a sense of the hierarchy of power. The HU in human means hierarchical power. He has a sense of hierarchical power, and he has a governing concept. And instead of devoting his physical life entirely to itself, and all his mental energies, and his psychological energies, and his spiritual forces, instead of dedicating all these into physicality and sensuality, pleasure, instead of that, he develops a governing concept. He posits the governing concept in there. And the more energy he puts into that concept, the more superior he becomes. Physiologically superior, higher up. Psychologically superior, meaning more feeling power. Spiritually superior, more intelligence. So that if his body is killed in a motor crash, instead of attenuating back to the field, as an animal does, it orientates around the governing concept. Now, you see this in a statement made by the great mystic St. John of the Cross, when he says, when you come finally to die, the thing that determines your eternal condition is the chief love of your life. The thing that you have loved in life is your governing concept. Where the treasure is, there is the heart also. So that you are able to define exactly what you love, and the more clearly you define it, the more that clarity of definition establishes a center of reference inside your psyche, your soul, such that on the death of the body, instead of attenuating and vanishing, you orientate around this governing concept, and you are then an immortal. You know that Christ said, what is it if you gain the world and lose your soul? Now, the word lose and loose are the same word. If you are so dedicated to the external world that you had no energy left over to contemplate how you would be eternally if designed by you instead of dictated to by the external stimulus. If you are able to define that, you do not loosen out. You do not lose your center of reference. You do not lose your soul. You are a soul and you are immortal. You are eternal. Now remember, the soul is the self-moving substantial being that forms the body. Your body is only food, but when you eat a cabbage or a carrot, you don't look like one. You break it down and make it look like you. The soul is the formative power, substance. Substance doesn't mean matter. Substance is the very depth, which is the foundation of all power, and that power is sentient. So that if you have an established governing concept to which you have dedicated yourself in life, you have actually built by your love that which at death remains your permanent possession. As Jesus says, you will go no more out. You won't fall down into passivity to the external stimulus. You will create the definition of the world that you will. And the world that you will match you exactly because you willed it. Your intellect, your formative power, your will, your dynamizing, initiating power will be exactly coincident, and you will survive the death of the body as an absolutely self-determinant being. A triplicity of conation, affection, cognition, but entirely active, and therefore not subject to external stimuli as in the hedonist pleasure lover, but entirely and absolutely happy because absolutely self-determined. Now in that state you have a sphere of sentient power, totally self-aware and able to stay where it is in eternity, or to identify again with the body and reincarnate at will. Now you know in yoga theory it says very clearly that when most people die they get trapped by their dreams of pleasures on earth and they go to a state where they enjoy their pleasures and they enjoy them and enjoy them. It may take thousands of years of repetition before you get bored. But eventually, they say, you will become sufficiently bored to want to complete your education. And then the thing that causes your incarnation is the memory of the pleasures that you had last time. So then the images of the pleasure activities that you had in the last life persisting draw you back again into an incarnation in an earth body where it would appear you can again experience exactly the same pleasures. And it is this cycle of coming on earth, being subject to pleasure, dying, going in a fantasy, remembering all your pleasures until you're bored, and then thinking, oh well, there must be more pleasure to be had, and so you drift down into incarnation and repeat it. That is that repetitive cycle that the Buddhists fight to get out of, and that the Hindu sages fought to get out of. Now the ideal is to be able to gather oneself together with a true hierarchical governing concept which has been seen to be true, worthy of possession, and absolutely efficient because it makes you totally active and never passive to an external object. And then you can come in and out of life at will. Absolutely self-determined. That is the goal. That is called the final aim, the goal, the mark, the end of life. What we know about the great leaders of religions is that they all taught more or less the same thing. There is a way out of identification, away from passivity to activity, away from subjection to pleasure, to the gaining of positive happiness and total self-determination. The way is a way of negatives. That is the ability to say no to a trap, no to an unexamined pleasure stimulus, and to examine it. The ability to control oneself sufficiently to examine the situation, to see whether it is genuine or whether it is simply a sensuous trap. All the yoga systems, all religious meditations, all have the same objective. They correspond so closely, you would have to say, that all these different systems have one origin. Now, what can that origin be? You see it in the little name, in the Buddhistic form, in the little program on TV called Monkey, a young fellow called Tripitaka, threefold basket, the triple basket, the basket of cognition, affection, cognition, the basket of sensuous drive, feeling evaluation of pleasure pain, and rational formal recognition of the situation giving rise to any of those affections or sensuous pleasures. When this threefold function is thoroughly understood, then, and only then, does one become actively self-determinant and therefore happy. Remember Spinoza's statement? Adequate knowledge equals activity equals happiness. Inadequate knowledge equals passivity equals misery. Activity and happiness, passivity and misery. And tell you the same thing. If you've got sufficient information in the forebrain, then we will have enough knowledge to control our own reflexes. If we examine people like the modern behaviorists or the Marxists, we find that they pretend that you are at the mercy of the stimulus, and they're always examining the kind of stimulus to see how to upset a brain, how to make a person enslaved, how to terrify a person into subjection and relative idiocy so that the establishment can control them. The opposite to that is the individual, and it can only be an individual, it cannot be a mass, the individual who becomes aware of his own triple nature and balances them exactly and says, these three are not enemies, they are friends. The serpent in Genesis is called the most subtle of all the beasts of the field. The most sensitive. It can sense pleasure millions of miles away. And it operates through the like-dislike, the affective level, and infects the reason until the reason recognizes the source of the infection and then decides to control it. Now, the word understanding is made from two words, substare, understanding, whence we get the word substance. There can be no possibility of understanding this triplicity of functions except in and by the substance itself. Substare, substance, to stand underneath. And what do we stand underneath? We stand underneath superficial phenomena. You see that in the book of Genesis, where it says the Spirit of God moved on the face of the waters. On the face. Now, the stirring of the waves, if you're in a boat and you look around and it's a sunny day, you see the sun glinting on the waves, and you cannot see what is under the water. But if you get a boat with a glass bottom, and the glass bottom presses on the water so that it can't make these sparkles, it is astonishing how deep down you can see. You can see the seaweeds waving about an ocean floor, you can see fish swimming, only because the water has stopped twinkling at you, throwing the sunlight in your eyes. Now this is the whole type of yogic exercise of whatever school. The mind, in its temporal aspect, middle finger, is forever scintillating at you, remembering things that were pleasurable and trying to suppress things that were painful. It is continuously doing the razzle-dazzle on you by telling you of infinite possibilities of fun and games. But if you flatten that mind, which you do by stilling the mind, you can then see right down to the bottom. And what you see is yourself unperturbed, your real self. Remember, the soul is sentient power, substance. Matter is not substance. Matter is only a modality of the energy, and substance itself is pure sentient power. So that when you quieten the mind consciously without falling asleep, what you actually do is become identified with your own sentient power substantiality. You know yourself to be an absolutely self-determined intelligent power, eternal, not temporal. The scintillations are a time, space, matter. But underneath, there are no scintillations there, there is pure being. And from there you can look up at the scintillations, see them from below, and that's called understanding. They are modes of activity of your own self. There is no scintillation, there is no razzle-dazzle other than that with which you fascinate yourself by your own intention. You tell yourself the fun stories about the fun and games and pleasures. You fascinate yourself with the images you project. Now you remember the long body of protoplasm. We are all parts of a protoplasm which has not yet died. Any living being, as you know perfectly well today, any living being is made of an ovum and the sperm of its parents. And the ovum and the sperm were alive in the parents, and they developed into you as an individual, and there is no break between you and that ovum and that sperm. But that ovum and that sperm were alive in the bodies of your mother and father, and they were alive in their father and mother, and so on backwards. So that any now living individual really has a continuous protoplasmic memory back to the original power of the universe, which in religion is called God, which in Buddhism is called the Ananda, absolute bliss, which in Hinduism is called Brahman, the extended power. Many names, one fact. The continuity of experience in the protoplasm of ourselves means that when we are doing the razzle-dazzle of ourselves, fantasizing, it is not merely that we are seeing the experiences that we have had since we were conceived or born, but through the sensitivity of the long line of protoplasm, we are seeing the fantasies of our mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers backwards, right to the very origin of the human race. In other words, we are being duped not only by our own present imagination, but by the imaginations of millions of ancestors that we thought no longer exist. How does it feel if you think that most, and I really mean most, nearly 100% of what you think is ancestral thinking persisting through your protoplasm? Nearly 100% of your likes and dislikes are not yours. They're conditionings of your ancestors' pleasures and pains from long ago. Now how do you like to be dictated to by a fantastical mass? Near the front door there is a painting showing Sophia, wisdom, a woman, and her gown is covered with little eyes. Each eye represents an individual. And on the side of the painting, next to looking at it, the left hand side to you, you will see a tree. And sitting at the base of a tree is a little figure going on. That's the devil. But the tree is full of ancestral faces. And the devil is saying, is it my fault if they want out? Now in the Hebrew there's a letter called Kof. Q-O-P-H spelled. Or Q-O-F. Q-O-P-H. Kof. It means ancestral imagery. Think of your ancestry, the whole of it, right back to the very beginning of time. Your total ancestry is with you now in your protoplasm, is vibrating, is telling you that you are to fulfill its desire, telling you that you're to do what your great-grandmother wanted you to do. And she's been told by her favorite great-grandfather what he wanted her to do. So you've been dictated to literally by millions and millions of ancestral impulses, and only insofar as they cancel out and contradict each other have you any freedom. And how do you feel if you're surrounded with millions of advisors? Supposing without previous consultation the few people in this room were to start giving advice to me. Yeah? But you don't consult with each other first. Now when you do this as a little exercise, now I'll tell you how it feels. Do not discuss with your next door neighbour, but start talking on the countdown. I'll count 3, 2, 1, 0, you start right. And you give me whatever advice you think is good for me, simultaneously and loudly. Will you do that? 3, 2, 1, 0. That wasn't very loud. I heard one clear shut up. Most of it was mumble. You know, it's a very funny mark about human audiences. They're so damned embarrassed by rotten education that they dare not speak when you ask them to. I mean, do me a favour. Okay, show me that. But say it loud. I want to see what it feels like as if I didn't know already. Have you got the feeling of it? Huh? I would be if I took any notice, wouldn't I? Luckily, I've got another concept. Yeah. Oh, I would be in a mess. It would be like a poor fellow who, if you know one, who consulted 17 psychiatrists. 17 in 6 months. Not bad. It costs a lot of money. Several were at Harley Street. And to the end of it, he didn't know what it was that they meant. Except that he could have pulled himself together.
How many going back there?
What is oneself until you define yourself? Nothing. You're an ancestral plasmic stream until you select your most loved concept and then build your universe with it. If you don't design yourself, you're just a long slurp. And that's the real meaning of Kierkegaard's existentialism. Either slurp or define yourself. It is actually possible to extricate oneself, but only on one condition. You have to stop slurping, define an absolute object of love, a governing concept. Something that in eternity you are prepared to pay everything for. Here's the definition of a saint and a sinner, used in the Middle Ages. A saint is a man who will sacrifice everything for God. A sinner is a man who will sacrifice God for anything. Now, as God means absolute presence of omnipotent intelligence. Who wouldn't sacrifice for that? Would you give anything up if you guarantee that if you do, all you gain is omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, a little thing? Would you cheerfully give up your raspberry plan for that? A baby wouldn't. No. Yes, if I was starving, I would still give up the flam. Yeah. Or the flannel. So therefore, the thing is quite simple. We are a triplicity, a tripitaka, of conation, affection, cognition, or primordial pleasure drive that refuses to think and is the subtlest of all beasts of the field. And the field is the infinite sentient power of the absolute. You know, in Einstein's theory of the unifield, imagine the field of the universe is pure power. That field. And the most subtle of that field, the finest perception in that field, is symbolized in the serpent. If you feel very carefully, you can actually feel in anything whatever, whether you like or dislike it. Doesn't matter what you see that thing there. Mm-hmm. What is it? If I put that like that, do you feel up? Yeah? Does that feel the same as that?
No.
Huh? Now you see, identification. It's possible for you with your own feeling to identify with something that somebody else is doing by simply mentally doing it yourself and seeing how you feel. And would you believe that that capacity is what is symbolized by the serpent in the Garden of Eden? You just refer to your own feeling. And funnily enough, it's called good taste. If you've got that kind of sensitivity, so you can tell the difference between a commercial art drawing and a Rembrandt, you've got that feeling. If you can't tell the difference between Pop and Mozart, you haven't. That feeling is the absolute self-awareness of the infinite field of sentient power which is God. It's called the heart of God. You know the Sacred Heart in Catholicism? That is what it's meant by. Now, you've seen the symbol of that heart. I'll draw it for you down here. There is a heart. Is that big enough for you to see? And there are some flames coming out like this. And there is a cross coming out. And down here like this. There's some thorns. And that's called the Sacred Heart, isn't it? It's actually a mnemonic used by the mystics of the church to meditate. The heart is called the Son of God, the feeling by which the divine knows absolutely everything in the field. The field is an infinite extension of sentient power in a state of tremulation, and the form of the tremulations is wisdom, Sophia. Now, when it feels, there arises from it fire, desire, for what it feels in it is information about something. The desire causes it to move out towards the thing it feels and focus it upon them. But you are then crucified on the thing that your desire takes you to. And then your heart is pinched with the crown of thorns, and every little thorn is a little desire that you allowed yourself to become passive to. So when you meditate on that Sacred Heart, in that way, it gives you a whole key to a total yoga. Primordial feeling, the serpent, a pure sense, the flaming desire that rises from it, the fact, unavoidable, of crucifixion if you desire. You will nail yourself, that's unavoidable. And then when you remember the things that you have nailed yourself upon, every little one will stick in you like a thorn. Now this meditation goes on in Golgotha. Golgotha means the place of the skull. And unless we are prepared to put our consciousness back and up into the down and out, there's your tummy, your appendage, whatever it is, you go back and up into the brain, and you make a shape, which is an interesting shape, which I will draw for you. It's a shape where that represents the brain, that's the spine. It's a Hebrew letter Nun, N-U-N, which is also in one modern language the word for now, and was also the word for now in ancient language. Nun means now, and the N-O-O-N of Dennis Sun also means now. You climb up towards it, and as soon as you get there you leave it. It means immediacy, now. If you are aware that the fall was from this part to that part, and the way back is from that part to that part, and the mediating line between, and you have that threefold awareness that you came down out of your primal innocency of an unanalyzed being, and in the process of coming down expose yourself to the passivity of their mind, and became subject to objective stimuli and enslaved. If you remember that you put yourself there, you can reposit yourself in the place of the skull. Now the great hero in the Old Testament is Joshua of Nun. Moses, who led his people out of Egypt towards the Promised Land, did not get into the Promised Land because he made a little mistake, a little egotistic mistake, in which he claimed that he had done a miracle that God had done. But Joshua of Nun, Joshua of the fish, Joshua of immediacy, he got in, and he was the great conqueror. And that name Joshua in the Hebrew, and Yeshua and Jesus are all spelt the same way, because they mean affirmation here and now is the Savior. To be here and now in immediate sensitivity of that serpent is salvation. And if you allow the mental inertia of defenses, or the memory of presence, or the present seeking of presence to fog your comprehension of yourself, you lose nowness, because the intellect is always looking at the memories of the past of pain and projecting into the future the system of defences, so it has no time for the immediacy of proper feeling. The intellect is always in the past and the future, never in the present. Funnily enough, the feminine, the Eve there, in the middle, is in the present. You all know that. Woman is very aware that the relation she wants is now. Purely a fact, a man will say, yes dear, I'll see you in 5 hours. Or 6 months, according to how far I've got to go on my next conference. I think I'll go to Tokyo out of the way for a bit and send you a postcard. Meanwhile, God knows what's happening at home. But the fact is that the absence of the male there, the intellective plotter, that's called Prometheus, the forethinker, and Epimetheus, the afterthinker, and the preoccupation with the past and the future there, in fear of the result of unadulterated pleasure there, misses the immediacy of the here now possibilities of the affective relation. And it is to woman that we have to look, and horribly enough to say, it is the woman who is responsible for the initial stimulus that made before. And it is she who has to reclaim the situation. And yet we have to say to the man, well, don't wait for her, because she won't wait. She will hammer you now to make you aware of now, if you promise her yesterday and tomorrow. Now it's upon this woman in the middle that the whole evolution of the human race depends, because the masculine forebrain intellection is entirely self-defensive. It cannot evolve of itself. It's a system of defensive. So it is only the feminine part in the midbrain there, feeling the approximation of the subtleties of pleasure, carries those into the forebrain to remind the man that he's got to transcend his defensive intellection. How many of you here don't know that men defend themselves? Are there any men here that don't know that they spend most of their time in self-defense? Are there any married men here? Do they consciously know that they spend a large amount of energy in self-defense against intelligent assessments by their lady friend or wife? It is the function of the lady to tempt and force the man to face his non-immediacy, and he to defend himself against it, because his defenses make her refine her temptations, while her temptations are making him refine his reason. Isn't it a simple problem?